Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining Where Is My Memory? Cognitive Changes in MS. Your host for today is Ms. Allison Serco. Ms. Serco, you may begin.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Allison, and I'm the Associate Vice President at the New Jersey Metro Chapter of the National MS Society. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's regional teleconference program. Tonight's program is Where Is My Memory? Cognitive Changes in MS. For those of you new to our teleconference series, I'll just run through the format. We'll begin with a presentation by our speakers, and then I'll ask a few questions that were submitted, and then if there's time, we will open up the line for some more questions. At the end of the program, I would like everyone to stay on the lines for a few quick polling questions that'll help us with future calls. At this time, I'd like to introduce tonight's speakers. First, we have John DeLuca. He's the Vice President for Research at Kessler Foundation Research Center in West Orange, New Jersey. He's a professor in the Departments of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and Neurology and Neuroscience at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, New Jersey Medical School. He's a licensed psychologist in the states of New York and New Jersey. Dr. DeLuca devotes 100% of his time to research and training. He's currently studying disorders of memory and information processing in a variety of clinical populations, including multiple sclerosis. And then we also have Jeffrey Gingold. Jeffrey is the internationally acclaimed author of the award-winning book, Facing the Cognitive Challenges of Multiple Sclerosis, and an outspoken volunteer advocate on MS and cognitive disability. He has been a guest on the Montel Williams Show, NPR, numerous webcasts, and national talk radio shows. In his second book, Mental Sharpening Stones, Managing the Cognitive Challenges of MS, Jeffrey provides strategies from people who have MS and medical providers sharing their tactical advice on how to manage the invisible MS. He was recently inducted to the 2010 National Multiple Sclerosis Society Hall of Fame for his advocacy efforts. Jeffrey is a published freelance writer and has authored numerous articles for U.S. and international publications. He enjoys spending family time with his wife, Terry, two adorable daughters, Lauren and Meredith, and one cat named Mickey, named after the baseball player, not the mouse. And at this time, Dr. DeLuca.
Thank you very much, Allison, and thank you all for joining us today. I'm very honored to be here to be able to speak to you all about a very important topic being cognition and MS. I believe there's an outline that you may have in front of you, and I'll try to keep to that outline, and I also try to keep to the time that I have. So let's start right off by saying, what is cognition? Cognition is one of the more complicated constructs, if not the most complicated constructs, that defines the humanness, and therefore is very difficult to define, yet we all know what it is. But let's try to define it. The dictionary defines it broadly as the act or process of knowing, but it's much more than that. So really what it is cognition is the ability to take information from the environment, process that information. So you receive it, process it in the brain, determine whether it's important to be learned or not, or to be stored in memory. And once it's in memory, you take that information and process it, do something with it so that you can work with it in your everyday life, and execute actions that need to be required, as well as expressing oneself in terms of what needs to be done. And all that complicated thing goes on in a little three-pound mass called the brain. And that's what we're going to talk about, is these cognitive problems. So let's start with a brief understanding, let me say that cognition is something that's specific, but not. But it's something that is only one part of being human. When we think about humanness, you know, we like to break the body up into its parts because we think of the skeletal system, the immune system, the nervous system, and we have experts that are associated with each of those. But in reality, the body works as a whole. Well, so does the mind. And cognition is just one interplay with cognitive problems, thinking, with emotional issues and personality. And the three of those things make up what we are, our mind. Tonight we're going to talk about just cognition. But remember, and you'll hear me say this, that those interplay between cognition, emotion, and personality really does determine how it affects everyday life. So we defined cognition broadly. Let's talk briefly about the frequency of cognitive problems in MS. You know, about 40 years ago, neurologists thought that only about 3% of people with MS had cognitive problems. Today, we know that's up to about two-thirds. About two out of every three people have some cognitive problems. That's a lot different than 3%. What happened to the people years ago when they were complaining about cognitive problems and people didn't believe them? Well, now we understand and we believe them. The degree of cognitive problem can vary from mild to moderate to severe, and it really is very different for each individual. So we're going to go through and discuss some of those differences. Now, if we look at what kinds of cognitive problems that people have, they can be broadly categorized into four categories. And I'll describe each of those. Well, first is learning and memory. The second is information processing speed. The third is executive functions. And the fourth I'll talk about is visual perception. And let's start with learning and memory. It's a huge problem with persons with MS. But memory is not a singular construct. Memory is very complicated. And there are aspects of memory that are actually not a problem with people with MS. For example, what's called semantic memory. Semantic memory is knowledge or recognition of meaning or meaning of words, recognizing objects. And persons with MS don't lose that information. So, for example, vocabulary words. You recognize words. You can remember those words. So semantic memory is not a problem. The problem more is in the what we're called episodic memory. So remembering events, remembering facts, remembering experiences, remembering details, as opposed to knowledge. That's really important because the knowledge part is what I'm going to say a little bit later about knowledge and intelligence, is really quite intact in persons with MS. It's just remembering that episodic memory, remembering those facts, remember those events, remembering those experiences, which become more of a problem. The other way to think about this very complicated construct of learning and memory is looking at what's called retrograde memory or anterograde memory. Retrograde memory is remembering things from a long time ago that have been passed, versus anterograde is remembering new things. Persons with MS have a problem more in remembering new things, not remembering things from a long time ago. So you can see even here the type of memory is very important. And there are lots of aspects of memory that are not impaired. We often like to focus on what's impaired, which is what we'll do today. But I want to let you know that there's a lot of aspects of memory that are not impaired, and we can use that knowledge. So what is the part of memory that is impaired? Well, you know, it was 20 years ago when I started the research that I was doing that people thought that persons with MS had problems in retrieving information from their brain once it was stored. Once it's in the brain, we can't get it out. But I found several flaws in that research. And what happened was that people in these studies never equated for the amount of information they originally learned. That is, if you don't know how much you've originally learned, you can't see how much you can remember from long-term storage. So we did a series of studies where we made sure people with MS learned the same amount of information as healthy controls. And so what we found was, once they learned the same amount of information, they remembered the information just as well as healthy controls. That is critically important. What that suggests is that the problem was not in retrieving information from areas of the brain that are already stored, but the problem was in learning new information. Critically important. Problems in learning. You can't remember anything you didn't learn. So it's not the problem with my recall or what people call my memory. That's telling us the problem is you have to learn it properly to begin with. And that's where we focus on rehabilitation, to make sure people learn. Because our research shows once you learn it, you will remember it as well as anybody else. That's a really important part of learning and memory. And the good news. The good news is then we know what that problem is. And once we know the problem is that you're not learning properly, we can do things to try to intervene to make sure you are learning. And so that brings me to the second problem with MS, which is probably the most significant problem, cognitive problem, and that is slowed information processing speed. What does that mean? Well, that means, you know, if you used to, I always use the computer analogy, if you were a very fast microprocessor, your brain before, today, after MS, if you're having these cognitive problems, your microprocessor is a slower one. Okay, you're not a Pentium computer before. Now you're at 286, if anybody remembers those. Now, the thing about that is, even the slow processor gets the right answer. It just takes more time. So what's happening is that the new brain is slower than the old brain. If it was just a computer, you just give it more time, and you get the right answer. But we're human beings. And that means when persons with MS are confronted with interactions in the environment with their families or work, and they find themselves not being able to find the right words, or it's much slower to come up with the right answer, we respond by getting a little nervous, a little anxious. Perhaps we start to withdraw a little bit, and have other problems, such as becoming depressed, et cetera, because what we don't recognize is that now the processing is slower. But you get the right answer if you take the time. So part of the intervention is to understand the new brain and to deal effectively with that slower processing speed. The other consequence of that slower processing speed is that you then learn less information, because processing is slower. So, for example, in this lecture tonight, I'm trying to be conscious of that, but I have a lot of material. But if the processing speed is slower, you may only remember 40% of what I'm telling you tonight, whereas if your processor was like it was before, you might remember 80%, only because you're not getting as much to begin with. So slowed processing speed can influence how much you initially learn. And if you don't learn it, you're not going to remember it. But remember, it's the learning problem, and processing speed can then affect learning. So that's the next big issue, is processing speed and how it affects learning and memory. The next thing I want to mention to you as the third big area is something that's called executive functions. And executive functions is complicated because it's the highest level of human processing. It involves planning, organization, initiation of tasks, problem solving, reasoning, forming concepts, and self-awareness. Very high-level construct. This is after you've taken information from the environment, after you've stored it, after you've processed it. Now you have to do something with it. You need to plan. You need to organize. You need to initiate. You need to solve problems. But if you have problems with executive functions, it's difficult to plan. It's difficult to organize. And it's difficult to reason through conceptual kinds of things. Those are not memory problems, by the way. Those are executive functions. One of the big problems that persons with MS have is differentiating between executive problems and memory problems. Oftentimes people come to me and say, my memory is terrible, I can't remember anything. And doing a short evaluation, I can determine maybe it's not so much the memory. But the problem is that you're not planning well. You're not organizing things like you used to. So, for example, if you're organizing your organization is not as good as it used to be, and you're losing your keys all the time. Maybe because you don't put your keys in the same spot like you used to. Now you just drop them and you don't even realize it. And you blame your memory. But it may be more of this executive dysfunction. It's really important area. There's not a lot of research on executive impairment. But another aspect of besides planning and organization is initiation. Think about that, initiation. It's interesting because the idea to want to initiate is different from actual initiating. And that could be part of the brain, not acting on the information you've already learned. Parts of the brain cannot make that initiation happen. And that's because of an executive problem. I know it's hard to understand. That's why it's important to seek a professional like a neuropsychologist to really understand and differentiate these various aspects of cognitive problems. Because while you can blame your memory and your family can blame your memory or your employer can blame your memory, it may be that maybe your processing speed is slower and your organizational skills are not the same. So that's what needs to be treated, and then your recall might get better. The last part is visual perception. Now, this is not a problem with your vision. A lot of persons with MS will have optic neuritis or inflammation of the optic nerve, which leads to blurred vision. This is not that. We're talking about the perception of the visual information that comes into the world. And so it may be difficulty in remembering where you parked your car at the mall because you don't have a good visual map of where it was. A lot of us never had that, okay? But some of us used to be really good at it. If you were an architect, you have very good visual skills, visual perceptual skills. But sometimes persons with MS lose that perceptual skills. And what's important is if you're not perceiving things, you won't remember it. So the intervention is to make sure that you understand and perceive the information correctly so that you can remember it, because our research shows if you learn it, you'll remember it. That's visual perception. Let's run to intelligence. Yeah, too often, I hear persons with MS tell me, I'm just not as smart as I used to be. Oh, I feel so stupid. I'm embarrassed. The work primarily suggests that intelligence does not change in persons with MS. It's not a problem with intelligence. However, persons with MS often confuse slowed processing speed with intelligence. So you may not be as fast as you used to be in coming up with the right answer, but you come up with the right answer. And so intelligence is generally not a big problem. Not the cognitive problem. It's more the interpretation by the patient and family that they don't seem to be as intelligent. But that's again very different from slowed processing speed or I'm not remembering because I'm not learning information properly. Those are not intelligence. Very important for our patients and families to know that intelligence is not an area that is significantly impaired. And the other area that's not significantly impaired is language. And I mean by that is the ability to comprehend and express oneself. Now, we know that persons with MS have word-finding problems, so it may be difficult to find the right word, and sometimes it's difficult to initiate the right response, but those are not language problems. Initiation might be an executive problem, and word-finding is a word-finding problem, perhaps even from slowed processing speed. But generally, persons with MS are able to communicate, able to speak, and able to express themselves, and they should have the confidence to do that, especially if you understand that your concepts might form slowly, your ability to express yourself might be a little bit slower, but it's important to know that it can be done because basic language is not impaired. So those are very important. How do these cognitive problems affect persons with MS and in their lives? And now Jeffrey is going to talk about that. And I just want to say a couple of quick words about it. you know, realizing that one has a cognitive problem or have symptoms of cognitive problems in MS is very difficult to accept. Very difficult for the person with MS. It's very difficult for family and its consequences, going to work, et cetera, et cetera. But it also doesn't mean that people are going crazy, quote unquote, is what I always hear. People with MS are not going crazy because of their cognitive problems. But it is something to say, okay, this is the me now. Let me understand what these cognitive issues are, and let me learn how to deal with it. Because if you feel stupid, you may then feel embarrassed. And if you feel embarrassed, you might get upset, which might lead to social isolation or family isolation, which could then lead to depression. You're not going out anymore, not being interested in activities you used to be find pleasurable, weight gain, all kinds of secondary, tertiary problems because you don't understand what's going on. So you can see these cognitive problems have an emotional overlay and can be influenced by one's personality. And so that's all I'm going to say, because I know Jeffrey's going to talk a lot about these in a very personal way that I think you can all understand better than what I can tell you, because I can tell you from the research what's going on. So let me move to how do cognitive problems relate to other aspects of the disease. One thing to know is that cognitive problems can be relatively independent of physical disability. So you can have a lot of physical disability and no cognitive problems, or no physical disability and a lot of cognitive problems. And it varies. This is one of the things about MS that we have. All of these things can vary individually. The nature of the problems can vary. The degree of cognitive problems can vary. The relationship between cognitive problems and these physical problems can vary. The disease course also has some significant influence. So, for example, early in the disease, even before one is finally diagnosed, if someone has clinically isolated syndrome, which means he didn't quite make the diagnosis, even then there could be cognitive problems. Or you can go very much later in the disease and be 20, 30 years post and have no cognitive problems. But in general, on average, there tends to be some progression in some patients with cognitive problems. That during the relapsing remitting phase, the problems are not as severe. You tend to see more processing speed problems and less executive problems. But as you progress farther into secondary progressive, the problems tend to get a little worse. But again, it's not absolute. Now, what about fatigue? Relationship between cognitive problems and fatigue. Now, fatigue and cognitive problems are the two primary symptoms of MS. The two most frequent symptoms. About 90% of persons with MS experience fatigue. And people often talk about cognitive fatigue. What's cognitive fatigue? Well, the quick answer is we have no idea. But people believe that during the course of a long day of work, or maybe that your fatigue is such that it makes it more difficult for persons with MS to concentrate. And so what happens is self-reported fatigue, how I feel, is often translated into I can or I cannot do a cognitive process. Well, what we've known is, and it's important to know this, for over 100 years of research, self-reported fatigue does not correlate with cognitive performance. That doesn't mean that you're feeling like you can't do anything. And you may be so fatigued that you don't want to do anything. But rest assured that that's a different feeling from actually being able to do a cognitive process. Again, I know that's very difficult to understand because, you know, the sense of a lot of patients is, I'm just so cognitively fatigued that I can't function. And that's fine. You're dealing with fatigue there. It's not necessarily cognition. It does not necessarily impact cognition, and that's important to know. How about depression? Depression may increase the severity of cognitive problems, but not across the board. It may have an effect on, let's call it, effortful tasks, tasks which take a lot of cognitive energy, but not necessarily on simple tasks, such as everyday kinds of activities. So depression can have an impact, but it's not necessarily impacting the primary cognitive problem. It's just adding that emotional overlay to make things a little bit more challenging. Stress is a big question that people talk about. And we know that stress, like depression, can exacerbate a cognitive problem. But again, the cognitive problem is a problem that's going on from the brain, from the neurons. Stress is just exacerbating it. It's not making the problem worse. It's just exacerbating it, if you can follow me. So that's why we say avoid stress. And that's true whether you have MS or you don't have MS. Now, it's interesting because here's where there is an example of the interplay between cognition, emotion, and personality. So we know, for example, that individuals who have adaptive coping skills, let's call it that, who are able to cope very well with challenges in their environment, that their response to treatment for depression is very good. And in fact, so therefore, they don't have the same emotional problems, emotional reactions which exacerbate the cognitive problems. But then there are people with personality skills who will call it less adaptive or maladaptive coping skills, who have a difficult time coping. Those make the cognitive problems even more challenging. And that's where we need to have even more help, because we need to deal with the personality issues, the emotional issues, as well as the cognitive issues. And so, again, cognition it's an interactive of the whole person. It's not something you can just see in isolation. And once again, that's why you see a specialist. And quite frankly, your specialist is not your neurologist. Typically, someone like a neuropsychologist. I think I'm doing okay with time. So I'm going to say that when we think about cognitive problems and how it affects everyday life, I like to talk about the primary problems of cognition. And the primary problems are what I just told you: learning and memory, processing speed, executive dysfunction, and visual perceptual skills. Those are the primary problems. Something is going on in the brain. The secondary problems are things which exacerbate the primary problems: the depression, the fatigue, the stress, medications that you might be on, side effects from medications, the fact that perhaps some people are, for better or worse, couch potatoes, you're not exercising anymore. All of those are secondary consequences which affect cognition. We can help the secondary aspects. There's a lot of things we can do to help depression, fatigue, stress, medication effects, and therefore improve that interplay between cognition, emotion, and personality. The primary problems we can also try to address, but we can't always change the brain. So what can we do about the primary problems? Well, quite frankly, there are no medications. There are no medications which have been shown to improve cognitive problems in MS. A lot of persons like to take medications like Aricept, which is medication for people with dementia, and they presumably help persons with dementia. They've not been found to be helpful in persons with MS. So medications are not that great. Some studies show there's an effect. Some studies say they're not. You should know that there are no approved medications for cognition. There are behavioral approaches, however, that have been shown to be helpful in helping the primary problems, mostly in a compensatory fashion. So, for example, if the problem is problems in learning information from the environment, then what you need to do is take control of your environment. Make sure you're learning. So if you're in a conversation, with somebody and someone's speaking to you, and you know that, you know, I'm having a problem because I'm never going to remember all this tomorrow. So you stop them. Slow down. Hold on one second. Let me see if I got you right, and try to repeat what they said. Is that what you're trying to say? And what you're doing is you're slowing things down, and you're making sure you learn it. Why is that important? Because now I know if I learn it, I'm going to remember it as well as anybody else, which means we all lose information. But you take control and stop people. Don't be embarrassed. Be active. Take it. This is too much. You know you're not going to learn and remember as much if you're at a party with 100 people, with all kinds of noise, kids running around. You're not going to remember that as much. So at a party, enjoy it. But don't be in a situation where you have to learn and have that noisy environment. Don't study. Try to avoid situations where you're not going to be able to learn because of the competing stimuli in the environment. The last thing I want to bring up is some good news, some important news. And some of the recent work that we've been doing here at the Kessler Foundation, we've been working on something that's called cognitive reserve. What does that mean? Well, we know that individuals who have been cognitively active all of their life, who've been very active intellectually, who read a lot, who are very engaged cognitively, that they are actually more resistant to the expression of MS. That is, they are less likely to show cognitive problems, less likely to show problems in learning and memory than people who have low cognitive reserve, who have not had a lot of intellectual stimulation in their lives. Importantly, people with high cognitive reserve and low cognitive reserve can have the same degree of disease, so they can have the same degree of brain atrophy, let's say, but the persons with high cognitive reserve are not showing the problem. They're not showing the cognitive problem. This is critically important. Why? That suggests that particularly people who are much younger, the intervention should be active, be mentally active, be physically active. We have research to suggest people who were physically active 20 years ago today have less brain atrophy and less cognitive problems. So, the cognitive reserve idea is to engage. And again, back to depression, back to personality. Get out into the world. Be active. Be cognitively active. If you like to play cards, play cards. Do puzzles. Be out in the environment with people. Be physically and cognitively active, because our research shows that you can actually delay the onset of disease parameters if you take control and be active. So I think I've come about to the end of my portion, and I know that I've said a lot, and I know that I've gone quite quickly, and I'd be glad to take questions at the very end of this. But I think now we're going to move on to the next stage, and Jeffrey will tell you about the impact of cognition on everyday life. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Doctor. Greetings, everybody. I want to thank the National MS Society for the invitation to share with you tonight, and Dr. DeLuca for his compassionate voice and insight. I kept shaking my head up and down as he was speaking, saying, yes, yes, that's right, I know what you mean. I was asked to share my experiences tonight dealing with the often invisible cognitive symptoms of MS. Yes, MS is a chronic, progressive, and brutally disabling disease, but it's definitely more than just the physical part. In 1996, MS was not in my plans. My wife and I were expecting our second child at the time. I was a litigation attorney, and I enjoyed running by the lakefront here in Wisconsin and ice speed skating. But like many people diagnosed with MS, my limbs began to numb and fatigue. Equilibrium threw me to the floor, and my vision became obstructed. And then the cognitive impediments showed up. I did not anticipate this. They delayed and confounded my thoughts, caused spoken words to be lost, trashed my multitasking, and sometimes obscured my ability to recall certain memories, familiar faces, tasks, obligations, locations, where I was going. For me, this is MS. It was a group of invisible symptoms with unanticipated disability. And people say, well, what exactly are you talking about? What I'd like to do is read a very short section from my first book on this topic, which is called Facing the Cognitive Challenges of MS. And this was when I was dealing with the physical aspects, and I didn't know, I was blindsided by cognition difficulties. And I was still a litigation attorney at the time. Although I believe that my denial about MS was under control, I was blindsided by a subtle yet powerful manifestation of this crippling disease. It hit without warning one day in court, hiding itself under the guise of MS-related fatigue. I was presenting a client's motion for contempt against her former partner that related to financial matters. During the prior 2 years, I had become very familiar with the history of Ms. Bartley's case because she frequently and often spontaneously dropped by my office to discuss her ongoing financial difficulties. The hearing would be routine because I regularly appeared before Judge Dreyfus and understood the open rhythm of his proceedings. Mr. Gingold, the judge asked from the bench, from your perspective, what do we need to do here today? Without warning, I was suddenly unable to answer. My prepared opening statement was gone from my mind. I was blank, void of all thought. The written phrases on my yellow legal pad were completely foreign. I turned to glance at my client in an effort to jar my opening lines, but her face was also unfamiliar. She tilted her head to look at me, waiting for me to speak, but I could only stare back, stunned by my loss of presence and unable to grasp my purpose. The growing silence in the courtroom underscored the problem as my desperate mind grasped for any notion of what was going on. I was trapped, but where? Now, what are the cognitive numbers? At the time that that happened to me, I didn't know cognition was part of MS. But now the MS Society says that up to 65% of the MS population, to a greater or lesser extent, may be dealing with some cognition difficulties. I like to just say at least half and call it at that. But these stealth MS cognitive symptoms are under-recognized, they're underdiagnosed, and often misdiagnosed. The cognitive decline that I have dealt with, it's a different type of numbing. In addition to the numbing I feel in my limbs sometimes, it's like living in an invisible mental wheelchair. Now, for the MS community and others facing these difficulties, they have two questions they never really ask. One, am I losing my mind? My opinion, no. Two, is there anything that you can do to slow down the disconnection of thoughts? Yes. When diagnosed with MS, you were probably not told, good luck, deal with it, handle it all by yourself. Hopefully you weren't told that. Now, you don't get to choose your symptoms or disability level with MS, but you do decide how to deal with it, especially the cognitive impediments. I found that learning to cope with memory and other thinking difficulties never occurs by itself, never. Since the therapies that are out there are not a cure yet, they're merely directional, we must be responsible by ourselves to keep our mind and our body active and to deal with these cognitive symptoms. There are three steps that I recommend. Each of us must first recognize, sometimes not by yourself, you may need professional help with this, and acknowledge your cognitive difficulties. You have to speak up because sometimes they are invisible. You can't just look at somebody and see that glazed look over the face and know what's the matter with them. Second, once you reach that point, you have to better understand these MS cognitive difficulties and how it's affecting or not your thinking and your memory. Again, useful to bring in a professional, a neuropsychologist maybe. And finally, once you do those two things, then you can learn to cope. You can ask and accept some help, some therapy, some techniques, strategies to get through those very embarrassing, sometimes difficult moments. You can benefit from the successful cognitive tactics of others, people who have been there, done that. Again, you don't have to do it by yourself. Now, my path, what I've encountered and how I've tried to deal with it, is not necessarily the same answer for everybody. My first book, I shared my MS cognitive difficulties and the methods that I struggled through. Sometimes I hit some dead ends that worked for myself. The second book that I helped put out there, Mental Sharpening Stones, shares the stories of some very well-known medical professionals and some very well-known people with MS, and they share their strategies for how they were able to maintain, despite MS and cognition difficulties, how they were able to maintain employment, marriage, and generally a vital life. It's difficult, if not impossible, to copy from anybody, but you can certainly learn from these skills. It's just like if you got in my car, if you sat in the driver's seat, you probably would have to adjust the seat. You'd have to adjust the rear view mirror, the side view mirrors, and you probably would pick a different station to listen to music other than what I listen to. It's the same thing with cognitive strategies. You have to adjust them and adapt them to fit your comfort, your needs, your safety. Now, how do you do that? I do advise you to get a cognitive game plan together. When dealing with a cognitive disconnected moment, I like to think that's the worst time to try to explain this to someone, a friend, a significant other. When they see that look in your face and you're struggling to remember a location, a direction, piece of information, and they say, what's the matter? You can't really take a commercial break from yourself and say, well, let me tell you about this cognitive difficulty I have and what the studies have said. You can't. It just all jams up. You need to talk about it in a calm moment outside of those sort of things. It's like being tossed into the middle of a football game that's already in play. You have to have a game plan before you step on the field, before you engage the opposition, whether it's the Patriots, Steelers, Giants, or whoever, or MS. You need to know what you're going to do when the problem arises. Remaining silent, either from stubbornness, self-isolation, lack of direction, whatever, can get you leveled. So start collecting an informed support team. Sometimes it starts with family, close friends, neurologists, doctors. Sometimes it includes occupational physical therapists, neuropsychologists, etc. You need to have this game plan assembled before these problems occur to lift yourself out of a mental wheelchair. Now, I was asked to share some common cognitive pitfalls that I've dealt with, and these are personal, but they may echo with other people. I've been asked, when I have difficulty retrieving memories, what do I do about it? Typically, I let it go. I strongly believe that the memory is still there, but the access to the information is being blocked. I will let it go, keep my mind calm. What I will do is I will write down the question and then the answer when it comes to me, because it will come back at some point. Sometimes at 2 in the morning, I may sit up and say, aha, Richard Nixon, that was the name I was thinking of, and nobody's amused by that, but that's the way it works sometimes. When I am not following a conversation, and Dr. DeLuca referred to this, if there's just too much noise in the room, too many people talking, what I'll do is I'll try to buy some time. I will ask the person to clarify or repeat what they were saying to give my brain time to catch up. I've been told that I do word switching. Sometimes the wrong word comes out, and I may or may not notice it. I try to note the frequency of that. My wife points it out, and I keep my neurologist informed. Sometimes a referral to a speech therapist may or may not be necessary. So what do I recommend? You need to have honest communication, a preemptive understanding with I call it a safety person, someone who knows what you're dealing with. Sometimes you need to bring in counseling, a third party to talk to a spouse, maybe much better than you trying to articulate what you're going through. Having someone who's uniquely qualified to explain MS cognitive challenges can ease the stress of the problems, also ease the problem in the relationship, while calmly directing you and the other person toward a workable solution. You want to take care of that thought out there that, hey, you must be making this up because I can't see this. I don't know what you're talking about. Now, you do have the right to be angry about all this, and you can get frustrated. My advice is to do something about it and avoid collateral damage. Refocus the frustration. What we've done is we formed an MS walk team, and during the past, I want to say 7 or 8 years, it surprised me, we've raised a little over $55,000 for MS, and that is doing something. I feel like we're a part of the solution. Show your family and your friends that this can be your MS legacy, as opposed to just not knowing and not talking about it. The truth is, by acknowledging cognitive difficulties, you're not surrendering to MS. Actually, you're finding your own mental sharpening stones, and you're keeping your brain sharp. My advice for you and your family is to take control of your cognitive challenges and stay in the game. Because while cognitive disabilities may be unseen, they definitely are real. You want to avoid being told, how many times have you heard this? But you look fine. You really don't. Why don't you remember simple details like you used to? It's not always visible. Share those difficult cognitive moments with family and friends and accept the help that's offered. Meanwhile, keep your body active and your brain sharp. I believe that a person is best defined by how they help others. Part of my passion has been to not leave MS on the table for our children to deal with. And the way I'm doing that, the books that I've talked about that have been mentioned here tonight, I donate 100% of all of my author royalties to MS research and education, 100%. So whether you purchase the books through Amazon, whatever, or you get it from the MS Society, I've donated stacks to their library, or you get it from a public library, I encourage you to engage the MS cognitive discussion. And hopefully there's time we can answer some of the questions. I appreciate you listening. If our moderator is still there.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay, there were a few questions that were submitted, so I'll start with those, and then if time allows, we'll open up the line for questions. The first question is, should I not point it out to my husband when he forgets, since it might frustrate him?
Well, that is sort of it's a great question, because it was sort of what I was trying to describe. Yes, you should talk to the husband about it, but not perhaps right in front of other people or in an embarrassing public moment. You want to find a quiet, calm moment and maybe ask him, when these things happen, how does he want you to handle it? What cues could you give him to help? And maybe he also needs a referral to an occupational therapist, or I don't know if you're allowed to attend the appointments with the neurologist, but maybe a neuropsychologist for specific direction. But I think it's appropriate to point it out in a non-confrontational way. You're basically saying, how can I help you? And hopefully that makes sense.
Okay, the next question. When I have that sudden feeling of not knowing where I am during a drive, for instance, on the way to a relative's house, how can I be sure it is only a temporary loss of memory, and is there anything specific I should do to prevent it from happening?
I have been there, done that, and I've been lost, or I should say confounded, just trying to drive home sometimes. That is where a safety person is useful, someone else who knows where you're going, and if they're in the car with you, you should be honest enough to say, I don't exactly know where I'm going. Can you remind me? Obviously, cell phones are helpful. I also like to bring a sheet of paper with me and write down the actual purpose and direction so I know where I'm going, because sometimes I will be in the car and I'll turn to myself or someone else is sitting there and I'll say, I don't remember what we're doing here. I remember how to drive the vehicle, but I've lost the presence of the moment. And I don't think, and I'm going to ask Dr. DeLuca to comment on this, I don't think that it's a permanent memory loss, because you don't necessarily, the way I had it described to me was that you're in trouble when you don't know where to drive the car. That's one thing. But you still know what a car is. If you start to not know what the car is or what roads are for and traffic lights, I think that's a different problem.
Yeah, those are definitely two different things. I would add that it is not a permanent loss of memory. It could be a very transient feeling of not exactly knowing where I'm going, what purpose I am for driving. And it's a good example of what I was talking about earlier about not having the secondary reaction, the secondary consequences. Oh, no. What am I doing? Oh, my God, what's happening? And having the emotional response exacerbate the problem. Because now it makes it much more difficult to figure out exactly what to do next. If you stay calm, pull over, get a cup of coffee. The reality is that the information will come back to you. Now, it may not come back right away. And again, there's a lot of issues here. You know, you can't speak about the particulars here. But to have a safety net, like Jeffrey said, is also very important. So call your confidant, the person you can say, by the way, yeah, you know that I'm on the road and I was going someplace. I just lost it for a moment. But the key is to not let it take over, is to remain calm and say, this is a part of my MS. I have not lost my memory. Whatever I'm doing will come back to me. Let me just take the time for my mind to regenerate. I would just avoid the secondary consequence.
Okay, the next question. How do I convince people that this is a real symptom and not just a sign that I'm getting old?
That's a great question, because like we were both talking about, it's often invisible and people can't see what's in your mind or what you're forgetting or having difficulties recalling. One of the easiest things to do, there's a pamphlet I'm aware of through the National MS Society. It's a very short pamphlet. It's called Solving Cognitive Problems, Managing Specific Issues. Get copies of that or make copies of pages from that and hand it to people who you think would honestly be interested and would read it and who want a better understanding. If they want a little bit more of a understanding, if the books that I've mentioned make sense to you, you can relate to those books, share the information. But I think, again, a discussion is appropriate if you have somebody who cares. And it's important to talk to them outside of the moment of your cognitive difficulty. Don't wait until something happens and expect to be able to explain it to them and be safe all at the same time.
I would add, ask yourself the question, why do I have to convince this person?
Yes.
This is very private. Now, there are people who you want to discuss this with, your spouse, your family. There are people who you may not want to discuss it with, your employer, but maybe they should understand something. So there's not an automatic having to convince people and explain to them what the problem is. Determine, come up with your own plan and what's important to you. What should people know about your private life and what should they not? And then try to discuss with somebody. Don't take it on by yourself, whether it's your spouse or a therapist, a way to deal with it. You don't have to explain anything to anybody at that moment. Do not, and like Jeffrey said, that's the worst time to do it. particularly when you're not going to only have the cognitive problem, you're going to have the emotional embarrassment, et cetera, et cetera. There's no need to convince anybody. You say, oh, excuse me, you know, and move on. And at a more appropriate time, in a way that is more comfortable for you, that's how you approach it. But determine. There's no automatic need for people to know. You don't have to convince anybody, just yourself and your loved ones.
And if I could add, I wouldn't recommend putting an entry on your Facebook page with copies of your MRIs and things like that. People won't necessarily understand, and maybe you don't want them to know, and you'll turn your Facebook entry into a face plant, and that's not what it's about.
Okay, we're a few minutes after 7:30. Are you guys okay taking a few questions?
I'm okay.
Sure.
Okay, operator, we'll open up the lines for a few questions at this time.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. If you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Our first question is from Beatrice. Beatrice, go ahead. Beatrice, your line is live. Please go ahead with your question. Our first question comes from Joseph. Joseph, go ahead.
Hi. You guys have done a great job. You've hit the nail on the head for me several times. I couldn't help but empathize with the person who was having trouble driving, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to use a navigation that's already installed in my car, so that's helped a lot. But I guess more in the lines of a suggestion, and I'm not quite sure which part of my deficit this falls in. That I was reading as we go along, and there's just so much material you guys have put out, and you know, God bless you for doing that. I think I know the answer, which is no. But are these recorded? And if so, can I go to the site and listen to them? In my case, it would be over and over. Also the one that hits me the closest is I'm trying to pull a word out, and I pride myself in being a wordsmith, or a thing or an occurrence or something, and I just can't, and the harder I try, the further it goes away. So I agree, Doc, that you mentioned, you know, just write it down and leave it alone. And to be honest with you, often in about 15 minutes it comes. So that's it. And if you have an answer about the recording, that would be nice.
I don't know the answer to the recording, so maybe Allison would know the answer. But I mean, the last thing you said, I think, is very important, that in about 15 minutes it comes back, which means the memory is there. It just may be hard to access, slow to access, particularly when it's embarrassing. But leave it alone. It will be there again. But I don't know about the recording.
Yes, I believe the call is being recorded, and we could provide you with the link that you can then download. Or you can just click the link and then you'll be able to hear the recording again.
Our next question is from Mark. Mark, go ahead.
Hi. My question is, if you need to actually get adaptation under the American with Disabilities Act because you have cognitive problems and have neuropsych testing that verifies such cognitive deficiencies, How, other than the job accommodation network, can you suggest, are there like templates for like how to write a letter to ask for accommodations from an employer, or who is the best person in terms of a specialist if you don't have an ongoing relationship with a neuropsychologist to help you assemble an effective letter that requests accommodations for memory deficiencies. But I do have one more question if you have time.
Well, Jeffrey, I'm not a lawyer. You are, but, you know, it is a law, and people have to accommodate. I mean, I think it's a complicated law because what is an accommodation?
It has to be a reasonable accommodation. The best thing, not knowing what state you're in, and the laws may obviously vary from state to state, but the easiest thing to do is to contact an attorney through the local bar association. Most often they have networks of attorneys who will talk for free and give you some general advice. And I don't know if you want to contact your local chapter of the MS Society. They probably also have attorneys they rely on to help people with MS with the exact question that you just asked.
Our next question is from Judah. Judah, go ahead.
I struggle with fatigue, and I also struggle with being scatterbrained, so to speak, and unable to focus. And Dr. DeGluca discussed that they're different from each other. Wanted to see if you, Dr. DeGluca, could talk about that a little bit more, just to so I can understand better what the difference between the two are, because I've always assumed that I've been unable to focus because of the fatigue. One other thing, too, I've heard a little bit about neuropsychologists tonight, and I wanted to understand more about what that is. I haven't heard about that about them before. Thanks.
Okay, well, you know, they really are, fatigue and cognitive problems really are dissociable, although they can have the same net effect. And so if you're very fatigued, you might feel like you don't want to engage in higher level cognitive intellectual activity because you're fatigued. If you're tired, if you're sleepy, you don't want to go out and play sports. So it might exacerbate the cognitive problems. But the reality is, and this is just from the research, is that fatigue itself is not necessarily going to result in cognitive worsening. It's just that it's the feeling that I can't do it. And so it's an important thing to try to differentiate, because by the end of the workday, you might be feeling a lot of fatigue and say, you know, I just can't do anything anymore. But you should know that the cognitive abilities that you had before are still there. Studies which have looked at cognitive performance at the beginning of a workday, at the end of a workday in persons with MS don't change. But the feeling of fatigue increases dramatically. So it's important to separate the two and work with somebody to understand the two. A neuropsychologist is a person with a PhD in psychology who specializes in understanding the relationship between the brain and behavior. It's not someone who sits behind the couch who is listening to your problems from an emotional perspective, although that is part of a neuropsychologist. But the neuropsychologist has specialized training in understanding brain and brain function and brain disease. And not all neuropsychologists know about MS, just like not all physicians know a lot about MS. But there are many neuropsychologists who know a lot about MS, the cognitive problems, the emotional response, the impact of stress and personality, and how they work together. That's the specialist that you'd want. I know a lot of people will go to the neurologist to look for somebody. Oftentimes, you might get a referral. You might be put on some medication. The neuropsychologist is specially trained in dealing with brain-behavior relationships, particularly if they know about MS, then they know the specifics about the cognitive problems what's going on in the brain and how it affects everyday life.
Our next question is from Carl. Carl, go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, so I've done the neuropsych exam, and they did come back with scattered executive function impairment and related it to MS. And then threw on top of that the possibility of depression. And so I've been meeting with psychiatrists, psychologists for the last year, year and a half, and they keep trying new drugs on me. And now they're thinking of trying I'm on Cymbalta now. That's not helping me. And they're thinking of trying Adderall. Have you heard Adderall having any success at all with helping cognitive impairment with patients with MS?
No. So the answer is no. There are no medications approved or that we know that will help patients with MS with cognition. Now, don't forget, cognition is a complex interaction between cognition, emotion, and personality. So if you take a medication that might decrease the anxiety, that take the edge off of certain kinds of feelings, that might help the cumulative overall cognitive effect. So let's say you have a, let's just say you have an 80% cognitive problem, whatever that means. If you take a medication to improve the anxiety, you might go down to 70% because it's not going to help the what I've called the primary cognitive problem. So it can take an edge off, perhaps, but there isn't a medication that's going to help your cognitive problem, and everybody with MS needs to know that. That's the bottom line.
Allison, do you want to start wrapping up?
Yep, I was going to say two more questions, and then we'll wrap it up.
Our next question is from Wendy. Wendy, go ahead.
Yes, this is actually Wendy's husband, Jason. I'm the one with MS. I'm going to be going to an evaluation. What should I expect testing-wise to be done, and maybe how long?
A neuropsychological evaluation, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, you know, it can vary a lot. It can vary by where you are, who you're seeing. Sometimes the evaluations are all done in one day over a period of time. Sometimes they are done over several days for any variety of reasons. You know, even though I say, and it's true, that the feeling of fatigue may not affect your performance, but if the feeling of fatigue makes you less willing to try hard, it's better to break it up. So what you can expect is an interview, a pretty lengthy interview about what the problems are, how you see them, a review of medical records, hopefully in advance. If not, you can bring your medical records with you. And then a series of what we would call tests. Tests are paper and pencil instruments, things you'll do. You'll draw, recognize things, do some reasoning. There'll be some verbal questions that are being asked of you, all designed to assess the areas that I outlined. Critically important to do your best, and if you're not your best, you're feeling fatigued and you feel like you can't do your best, say, can we come back another time? That's pretty much what I think you can expect in terms of the testing session. And afterwards, you know, they'll be able to tell you the results of the evaluation, but don't stop there. What can I do about this evaluation? What's the next step? What's the plan? Come up with the plan with that neuropsychologist, with your neurologist, and whoever else you're working with to solve these problems. And be part of that plan. And if it's not working, change it. Engage.
If I can also add, from a patient's perspective, you have a right and should consider requesting a copy of the report, because the information, whatever they find, it can be so thick that you'll walk out of the appointment saying, what did they tell me? What's the matter? If you have a bring somebody with you, your wife, or get a copy of the report so you can take it home, read it over, and then maybe you'll go back and have more specific questions, that can be helpful. I've done a couple of those tests, and the best thing I can tell you as far as being a patient is concerned is it doesn't involve needles or blood tests, which makes me smile.
Or electricity.
Yes.
Our final question comes from Bernardo. Bernardo, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. And thank you, Jeffrey. Your talk today has been very informative. My question relates to word retrieval and word finding, and Joseph touched on it a little bit. I do find myself having trouble coming up with the correct word at times. Dr. DeLuca, I'm curious, where does that fit into the four different categories that you initially spoke about? And what can be done about that aside from what you've maybe talked about today? Thanks again.
Yeah, it's a complicated aspect. It's one of the more familiar problems, you know. It can come from either slowed processing speed, so that, again, from a sort of an inefficient brain, quickly accessing and information, quickly finding the label to the concept is not there. So it's not so quick. And what makes it worse is the recognition that it's not there. Therefore, I'm a little embarrassed, and it makes it even worse. So it could be a processing speed problem, or it can be an executive problem. An executive problem is that the search engine to go find that word is not working efficiently. And so, therefore, the same thing can happen because I'm not finding it because of an executive problem. You're not going to the right cabinet to find that word. Then you can have an emotional response and make it worse. Unfortunately, there's not much that can be done about it other than the recognition that it's happening and try to come up with a means of when that happens, what will I do? So being prepared for that. And it may be, again, well, don't worry, I can't find the answer. But what I can describe is try to describe the thing you're trying to say. So it's a very difficult thing. And there's no like way to quickly find that information. It's just the recognition that it's happening and to don't get flustered by it and try to continue with the line of reasoning in a different way.
And the worst thing may be that you'll just have to simply write down a cue to yourself if you really, really need that word and you just it's on the tip of your tongue and it just won't come out. Write down the cue of what you're searching for. It will come to you probably later. It's also helpful if you have a significant other or someone who's typically with you to tell them not to prompt you. For me, it drives me nuts when people try to give me the word and all these different words start coming at it. I keep saying, no, that's not it. That's not it. Quiet, quiet, quiet. That's not it. With time, just quiet your mind and chances are it will come back and then write it down as soon as it does come back because you may not remember it later.
Okay, at this time, I'd like to thank Dr. DeLuca and Jeffrey for joining us tonight and for this very informative presentation. I'd also like to thank all of our members who called in tonight. We're happy to have you with us. Again, for those of you that are interested in Jeffrey's books that he talked about, if you order directly from the publisher, you can receive a special discount. Visit demoshealth.com, and you can utilize this code SS. GINGOLD 30 when you make the purchase. I'd also like to remind everyone that they can contact their local chapter of the MS Society for a variety of information and referrals. At this time, I would like to have the conferencing company take a quick polling of a few questions. Again, thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed this program and have a great evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, this begins our polling session. Our first question, I can name at least one thing I learned about cognition changes in MS. Press one for agree, press two for disagree, press three for no opinion, does not apply. Again, I can name at least one new thing I learned about cognition changes in MS. Press one for agree, two for disagree, three for no opinion, does not apply. The poll for this question is now closed. Please hold while we prepare our next question. Our second question. I can name at least one new strategy to improve my memory. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, 3 for no opinion does not apply. Again, I can name at least one new strategy to improve my memory. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, 3 for no opinion does not apply. The poll for this question is now closed. Please hold while we prepare our next question. Our next question. I feel the speakers were very knowledgeable on the topic of cognition changes in MS. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, 3 for no opinion does not apply. Again, I feel the speakers were very knowledgeable on the topic of cognition changes in MS. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, 3 for no opinion does not apply. The poll for this question is now closed. Please hold while we prepare our final question. Final question. I enjoy learning through a teleconference format. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree. Again, I enjoy learning through a teleconference format. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our polling session. You may all disconnect.